This is Stephen Vaughn. It's September the 4th, 1996, and this is a continuation of an oral history that had begun some weeks ago with Professor William Hackton, or Bill Hackton. And we're going to talk today, I suppose, about your years as director.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We've gotten up to that point, and maybe we could begin by simply your saying a little bit about those years and what you feel were the problems and accomplishments and so forth.
Yeah, well, I was director from in 1975 through 1980. It was five academic years, and I had been it was unusual that he had that, but Bud was getting kind of overwhelmed by all the work involved, and so he convinced the dean to let have a half-time person as assistant director. So,
when did the assistant director come about?
Well, that must have been probably 73 to 75. It was right after I'd come back from Ghana, Fulbright in Ghana, and I guess it was the fall of 73.
I think I remember when I came here when Steve Chaffee was director in 1981, that he had an assistant director, if I recall. Is that right?
Well, no, that's not quite right. The Susie Branchard acted as the assistant to the director, but she was not an academic person, of course. And so, so I did it on a half-time basis for 2 years, and then I became director. But after I became director, I had one of the first things I decided is I didn't want to have an assistant director because I found it was a difficult thing to do. It was half-time teach and half-time administration. But although he was a dear friend and all, really wouldn't delegate things very much to me. So it was kind of a frustrating thing. Not that we didn't get along, but and I decided a better use of resources was that it was, I recognized that Bud did too, but I recognized that Susie Branchard's abilities, and so we convinced the dean to have her become first of all, I had to move her to academic staff. See, she was there here as civil service, as a secretary.
Okay.
And then, so we had to get her to academic staff, which took some doing because Susie did not have a BA degree at that time. Everybody was impressed by her ability and all. And so we did get it through, and the dean supported it. And then she pretty much stayed in that position.
Did she later get a BA degree? Or?
Well, I know she took a lot of. I know she was taking courses. She had had some college, and I know she took a bunch of courses, but I'm not sure if she ever finished them. So that's the way it was. And so then I started in the fall of '75, and with Susie as the administrative assistant, and was doing a lot of the same things I was doing. One thing I would, but always very thorough in his administration and all. He really broke me in very carefully. I mean, he told me everything that had to be done, you know, and so that was a big help, you know, that he had. And then he went off for a year's leave at that time, and so it was a big help to have him give me a good start that way. And
what were the big challenges? I mean, what was the, I guess maybe the biggest change when you took over as director from your previous role as a professor?
Yeah, well, the fact that, I guess the thing you feel right away, the thing that I felt was that you were, it was a position of responsibility in the sense that, you know, the buck stops here and you were sort of had the overall responsibility of seeing things that get, see that things get done. And that, and also, it's funny too that I had, one thing that I didn't expect, but you sort of, director sort of sees himself as an advocate for the students, in a sense that I hadn't thought, because everybody else has got their own interests and areas and responsibilities, and so oftentimes I felt myself in a position of sort of looking at it or from the point of view of the students. And well, one of the things that you know, right off the bat, and this has been happening ever since. We were at that time. We were still getting more and more students every year, and this happened before Watergate. You know, the conventional wisdom for at least the outside world was that the journalism enrollment started with Watergate, came as a result of Watergate and all the publicity of Woodward and Bernstein. But there's very good evidence that it started about 2 years before that, and probably around 1970. But we were still feeling the brunt of it. I mean, the numbers were increasing greatly, and we had at that time, you know, certainly during several years when I was director, we had more undergraduate majors than any department in letters and science, which is the big teaching college in the university. We had more majors than English or history or any sociology or anybody.
Well, what do you think accounts for that increase that starts then?
It started, I think it was just a kind of a general recognition of the sort of the power and influence of media in society. Of course, it was coming not only in the news editorial area, but it was coming in public relations and advertising and just careers were, and it was, you know, along with the changes in media technology and so forth, the country was just becoming more and more aware of this. And there were more, and also there were plenty of job opportunities too, you know, because a lot of the sort of non-news media areas, the non-conventional areas were opening up, like not only PR, but sort of small publications and representatives of trade groups, and, you know, because they had some kind of a communication aspect and so on. So it was a, and this was a big problem, of course, for us, because we still had a comparatively small staff, and we had, we did not yet, and this was also at a time when the university was starting to feel a squeeze on, economic squeeze, and so they were not, they were very tight with positions, and they were reluctant to give us new positions, even though we had the students.
I would think by the late 70s, the great expansion that we associate with the 60s had begun to decline.
And that's right. That's right.
There were a number of areas I think it was getting pretty hard to find jobs in.
But the thing of it was, we didn't do well on the student credit hours. And when you go and see the dean, they'd say, well, we need more positions. Because we didn't, at that time, we didn't have an awful lot of, we didn't have many non-majors taking our courses. Whereas political science or history, other social studies courses, departments, were also, you know, taking students from other departments, so we didn't have that, even though we had lots of small classes, you know, with editing and reporting classes and so forth. So we were hit by that, and so that was always a big problem all through those years, and because we just had a lot of students, and we had big lectures, you know, and it slowed down later, and so that was a constant problem of how to get how to deal with those numbers.
Could I ask one other thing?
Sure.
About, you said that the increase in journalism majors started before Watergate. Did Watergate and of course the movie that was done after that,
did
that have an impact?
Oh, yeah.
What did it seem to do for the field?
Well, I think that it also sort of glamorized journalism to a certain extent. Some people think in the long term it was a deleterious effect because it tended to make the press increasingly cynical and about government and people in government. And I think some people say that they're feeling that today, the way press treats presidents and so forth. But certainly at that time there was a good deal of idealism with this too, and a lot of papers around the country were doing a lot of investigative reporting, became a lot more popular, and it was being done on a lot of different levels.
The cynicism you speak about, was that, when did that begin to appear, or was that always part of the profession while you've been here?
I think the whole idea of a healthy skepticism, you know, a skepticism of government and that you have to really keep an eye on them, and you have to watch out for, you know, what interests are taken care of, and I think that's been there a long time, but I think that there's the feeling, and I think that you see it today, the criticism of the press, that this healthy skepticism has changed into kind of a cynicism, you know, and a
They just have to.
Is that a result of Vietnam, Watergate, or?
I would say so. I think the Vietnam area was a big part of it. And the I was just reading something, doing something recently on criticism of the press, and just recently had the convention in Chicago, the 68 convention, which was that wild convention, but. There was something that was spawned at that time, maybe just before. It was the Chicago Journalism Review, which was put out, a small journalism review that was put out by members, working members of newspapers in Chicago, highly critical of what their newspapers were doing. That they weren't being tough enough, or they were too cozy with government and so forth. And they said, they pointed out that something like 48 press reviews sprung up in the years immediately after that. Most of them disappeared in a few years, but they were just all over the country. And these were mostly by the working press, and that it was part of it was based on the idea that you got to be tougher with government, but also that their own papers were too timid in the face of, of what government was doing. Mm-hmm. So I think there were seeds of that, that were just coming along in various ways. But back to journalism education, sort of a related problem that I was very much aware of as a director was the fact of the difficulty of increasing difficulty of getting tenure for people, candidates for positions here, who had strong professional backgrounds but were somewhat weaker in academic, having an advanced degree or the kind of research interests and so forth that the divisional committees would go for, and this was becoming more and more of a struggle. And the divisional committees at that time, I think, were reflecting the fact that of the tightening up of positions in the university, that were being really tough on people that we were bringing forward, And there were a couple of people in particular. One guy, can I name names?
Sure, well,
with Dan Drew, who's a very able guy.
Did you ever know him?
Sure. Yeah. Well, and he was a broadcasting guy with good professional experience, but he also had a PhD, Indiana, I guess, and very, very capable person. Well, he failed. I mean, he was turned down by the divisional committee. And we objected and appealed it, and it was a big struggle, and with a lot of help from Jack McCloud. We got to reverse the position, the decision. But ordinarily there shouldn't have been any problem with that. But that reflected the fact that journalism and that professional qualifications and so forth didn't swing that much weight in what was increasingly seen itself as a research.
Yeah. Were there other people who had that kind of problem?
Well, it also became a problem on who we would consider to hire. We'd realize that somebody like, or we would try to convince the dean that we want to hire somebody that was has a straight professional background, and that they weren't very receptive to that either. Even though we had several people on the faculty at that time, who were in that category, like Hartley Howe was a person who didn't have it. I think he just had a BA degree, but he had a lot of qualifications.
This business about becoming more of a research faculty or university, if I could follow up something that I talked to Bud about. Bud said he thought he saw a decline in the ideal of service.
Yeah.
While he was, particularly during his tenure as director, that people weren't as interested in taking part in the larger community. They became more specialized.
Yeah.
Was that a, do you think, a continuing problem?
I was aware of that too, and there was sort of an increasing reluctance on the part of faculty to take part in what we call public service activities, such as attending the meetings, the yearly or semi-yearly meetings of the Associated Press, of the Wisconsin Press Association. In the past, under Knapsiger and then Bud, there was very much of an effort to get as many of the faculty involved in participating in these things, as well as our the programs, the short courses and seminars we put on to these people. There was more and more reluctance to get involved in that. That reflected the fact, on the one hand, that that a lot of the people that were on the faculty then had less experience, didn't have working experience in the media, so it was a little harder to relate to these guys. But also, you know, they just saw more and more the demands of their own careers were that your allegiance was to your discipline and to the kind of research things you did. And so it was more important for you to go to the kind of research meetings and do research that was that directly affected your and I think that was a decline. That's been a decline generally in journalism education.
Also the tenure process puts less emphasis on that than it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You know,
if you're talking about having difficulty getting professional people tenured, it suggests that. I don't know what that suggests, but it might be a reflection of that.
Yeah, right. And when I first came to Wisconsin as a junior faculty member, we used to, as faculty members, I won't go into the whole structure of extension, but we in effect did a lot of extension things ourselves, and then after about 10, 15 years, due to some structural changes in the university, the extension departments of communications or journalism tended to take over some of that, so we didn't have the kind of direct responsibility that we did have earlier. Mm. And so that tended to remove us even more so from and I think that's not been good for journalism education generally, because I think there's been a part in the ways of certainly at the state level and also theoretically, at least sort of the theory, or pack my thoughts on this. Sort of the prevailing wisdom when during Ralph Snapsinger's days and certainly the Bud was that a school of journalism in a land grant university had a very significant kind of a role. And this would relate to the fact that there were good schools of journalism in other land grant universities, in Minnesota, Iowa, Indiana, Michigan State, and so on, Illinois. And the idea being that a land grant university, a school of journalism and mass communication, provides a service to the state by training people who work on the weekly papers, the small dailies, and also it provides a service by helping to provide short courses or advanced training for these people and in keeping in touch with them. But also they act as a PR representative of the university. I mean, to bring these guys to campus, we did it quite a while. We always had a big weekend with the weekly editors who came in from all over the state. There'd be about 60 or 70 of them. It was really kind of an excursion for these guys. But they'd come to Madison, from the little towns all over Wisconsin. But, and then we'd have a few sort of courses. They'd always go to a football game the next day, and there'd be a nice banquet. But it was very good public relations for the university, And that also helped us vis-a-vis the administration, because they recognized the importance of staying on the right side of these guys, because they've all got newspapers and they've all got communities. And these guys were, just terribly loyal to the university, and this was their one big chance once a year to come into the university.
When did that tradition kind of begin to break down? When did it stop? I gather it's something you continued when you were...
Yeah, it was still being done, and I think it was around 1980 or so. Jack Newman, who was in the news service, was in the news service, but also was a part-time in journalism, used to teach the broadcast courses, and he was always very heavily involved in doing this. Mm-hmm. But it faded away around 1980.
I remember coming here in 81, and I don't recall ever having asked or even heard about anything like that.
Right.
It sounds
that's
to me
right.
like a very good...
It was the fall meeting. Did Bud talk about this? It was the fall meeting. Bud and his talk to you. About the fall meeting of the WNA, the Wisconsin Newspaper Association.
I don't think so. No, he didn't talk about that.
At first, the organization at that time was all weekly papers, and then they later merged with the dailies into a single group. Mm-hmm. It was always kind of a big event. And also, Napster would always try to get all the faculty to come to these things, certainly come to the dinner. You know, it would be a big dinner on a Friday night before, and then get the cheerleaders there and so forth.
Anyway, you had some other things you were going to talk about relating to journalism education, and maybe you have in some ways some notes, or maybe we could touch on those points.
Well, I think that we had that, at least I had, and I suppose all of us had it too, was sort of a continuing problem of finding people to teach public relations. And
now, was Scott Cutliffe still here? Or?
Scott, it was about the time Scott left that it became, when Scott was here, we were always well fixed in it. And, he went to Georgia.
Georgia, yeah.
Yeah, and he was there for a year as a visitor. Then he stayed, and so I guess it was a problem when I was director. That and it's a kind of a funny thing that there were three or four people. I'm having a little problem with names today. Byron Reeves was one. He was a very good guy, and Glenn. You remember Glenn?
I remember Glenn, but it was before my time. So.
He went to San Diego State. Very nice guy. And there were several people that came along, and they were people that were had PhDs, and they were able people and good teachers. So they get the public relations course to teach, and they had research interests that seemed to tie in, but they never really wanted to teach it, you know. They teach it for about a year or so, then they try to beg off and get to teach something else. And this just became a whole succession of people. Mm-hmm. And Jim Danowski was a guy we brought him from, was here. He had a Michigan State PhD, but he spent time at USC. Well, he was here for several years, and he didn't, I think he left before he came up for tenure, but he struggled with it too, you know, and it was a, and I guess it was kind of a problem of, that there's sort of the problem of teaching it as a professional related, as a pre-professional course for people going into public relations, was difficult for people who had backgrounds in the sort of theoretical aspects of all this, sort of persuasion and influence.
Just teaching that as a, well, I thought Scott Cutliffe's last book, The Unseen Power, is a great title, because it is such a, you know, major force, whether you talk about politics or business or whatever, that it's something that needs to be taught, I think at a professional level, but, you know, in a more detached level, where you kind of look at its social impact.
Yeah, right.
But we found, you know, interestingly, a few years ago I was head of a search committee and we were trying to hire somebody in PR, and we could only find maybe four or five people in the whole country that did research.
That's right, it's always been tenurable.
And so so that made it a difficult
thing. Yeah, that's right. And it's also, and Scott was very good because Scott could really knew it from the point of view of teaching people that are going into the jobs. Mm-hmm. Although Scott's approach was, and the one that I always thought was pretty good, was that he thought if somebody's preparing for a PR career, should be first of all trained as a newsman, and should be told to know how to write news and understand what news is, and
be able to distinguish news from PR.
Yeah, right, that's right, and because part of the idea of good public relations that you prepare your messages and so forth the way that they are at least appear to be news, you know, So he was very good there and training people, but also he also understood the broader theoretical aspects as well as the societal thing, you know, the role in the, you know, the whole problems we have now with lobbying and all is also tied into public relations. And it could be taught in those days, I guess still is, there were sort of often related courses in political science, like public opinion and propaganda, and or sociology would sometimes have a course like this, and the whole literature of both public opinion and propaganda.
Well, I think we've had some recent discussions about PR here, and it continues to be a problem, and when we changed the graduate curriculum last year, I think, I don't know, I'd have to go back, but there was a lot of different language that was used, and so
I think it's a continuing problem.
Yeah.
But it also there were efforts in those days, and I guess more recently, that to try to combine advertising and public relations, you know, to try to get to bring them closer together. Well, there was opposition to that, and sometimes it comes down to personalities, because Scott Cutliffe didn't want having to do with advertising, and advertising didn't want anything to do with public opinion.
I've never been convinced there's a sharp line between the two. But
yeah, they're persuasive communication.
That's right.
So that's but some of those kind of problems were never really really solved. One other point that just sort of occurred to me in thinking about this, that in those days we had a very well-balanced faculty in the sense that...
balanced in what sense?
Well, it was... for one thing, it was very collegial. You know, the people really got along very well. And it was part of a long tradition in the school that even though there might be some people that were backed up now and then, the general collegial relationships between people were very good.
Mm-hmm.
And that we were not, people might have real disagreements on research procedure, research interests and so forth, or what ought to be taught in school of journalism, but they personally got along very well. And so that was always a good thing. But also in those days, it was before there was a whole series of retirements, but we had a very good balance between people with theoretical interests as well as people with more broader interests. It's also a balance between people in the behavioral and quantitative area as against history and law and so forth. And so there was just a very good kind of a balance that...
That's one of the things that struck me when I came here in 1981 was that it was a very collegial environment.
Yeah.
I think that's quite true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I know that Arv Schlaben, the former editor of the Milwaukee Journal, and who was always among editors, and very unusual among major editors, that he always had a real close interest with journalism education and worked through the American Society of Newspaper Editors, worked very closely with and helping and cooperating with schools of journalism. Well, he expressed that idea very much, and he thought that our faculty was the best faculty around at that time. And he got around the country a lot. Of course, it may just been his pre-election tour in Wisconsin, but he just felt that we were and because of this kind of a balance, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But then we started having a whole series of retirements, and this really came, well, during my time and more after, the whole string of retirements that tended to be very heavy on the people with professional backgrounds or professional interests. So that people like Ragsdale and Hartley Howe and Jim Fosdick and John McMillian and
Chuck Higby,
that's right. And even those people had other academic interests, but they had this sort of an affinity to an approach to the professional side that we all pretty much had in common. Well, then that tended to thin out, you know, as you get more other people or younger people coming in who hadn't had that experience. So that tended to make some kind of a fair amount of change.
Was one of the things, maybe in the collegiality, the fact that most of the people who were on the faculty had either come out of, they'd been practicing journalists, or they'd come out of journalism and mass communication programs? My sense is that somewhere beginning in the late 70s or early 80s that the school began to hire people from different disciplines.
There'd been some of that. Jack McLeod, of course, that sociology.
He came out of a sociology
background.
Okay.
But he was an undergraduate here at Wisconsin, and I think he was an undergraduate in journalism, as a matter of fact. But I think that tended to be more the case, in part because of Hardy, when we were looking for, when about the time Bud was retiring, and we were looking for people with history background, you know, because we developed this whole area of journalism history here, and also we were at a point where we had pretty well decided we were going to not hire our own graduates. Mm-hmm. So seeing who was available, people like Jim Boffman knew, stood up, and so that tended to be.
What are some of the other things here that you see as issues during your tenure?
Well, one thing we did, this isn't an issue, but one of the big efforts while I was there was to, we put on the, we were host to the AEJ convention. In 1977, we had, we were host to the convention, and we'd been,
now the AEJ and CF until just a, well, relatively recently, you used to meet at college campus.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. And it was always in the host school. We went through a hell of a lot of work to put one on. I mean, it was a big job. And some people here were reluctant to do, for us to do it because they felt it would put too much, put too much burden on the junior faculty who were all trying to get research done so they could get tenure and so forth. And so there was some reluctance to do it, you know, to take it on. But we felt we should do it, and it was, you know, good for the school to do this. And so we did put it on, and the way we dealt with it, the way I dealt with it, because I was the director then, and was to, I put buttons. Bud had, was still here, and he didn't retire until 81, I guess.
81, that's correct.
Yeah, 81, that's right. And so, and he just came back from leave, and he was kind of a, and he was finding it difficult to get back into research after being in administration for so long. And so I asked him to take charge of preparing the convention. And of course, he just loved to do it, you know.
Now, how many people did you have come for that?
Well, it was well attended by those standards in those days. It was very well attended. And also Susie was a great help. Yeah. Susie and Bud really
we've hosted the Midwest Journalism History Association a couple of times since I've been here, but that's pretty small compared to the AEJ.
And on a college campus. Of course, the university here was well suited for it, and weather, and able to use the dorms, there were always problems with university. With programs at universities, oftentimes the food would be terrible, you know. And I remember a couple of conventions I've been to, the food is so bad, it just sort of took over the convention. Everybody was talking about how bad the food was, for instance here, the dorms, the people in charge of the commons and so forth, they've got this ability to put on a much better food.
Well, now you had mentioned last time when we talked the importance of having connections to associations like this for the school, in terms of its national standing, the way we're perceived, and I would think that would be a very good way to kind of draw connections.
Oh yeah, that's right. And at that time, Wisconsin was one of the first to really get graduate students to deliver papers, have papers delivered by graduate students. You know, it was really in the early 60s, the AEJ was really changing from an association of administrators that got together, talked about their common problems, to one that was more and more like a more traditional academic disciplines annual meeting, where and more and more research sessions and so forth. And so we were very much involved in that, but then also we were one of the first to, for our own students, were giving papers and doing it very well, you know, and PhD, you know, mainly PhD students, but in the quantitative area as well as in the history of law and so forth, our students did very well, and that tended to be picked up by other universities as that time went on. But also, of course, as a school, we were. It was a slightly different association then, I think, than now. But certainly there was more faculty involvement, in part because of this research thing. You know that our faculty would be involved in the research part of it because with their students there, and particularly Jack and Steve, their students were just all over the place. You know, and but the law and history students as well, and some international students as well. So that it's kind of too bad that we've kind of drifted away from that. I think the association's changed a lot too. You know, I don't think it's the same kind of organization.
It seems to me it's gotten awfully specialized in terms of there's a category for almost every little thing, and it's hard to imagine quality when you have things paired off in
Yeah, that's right. And you know, it's interesting that Bud chaired the committee that really reorganized it and set up all these divisions. And,
I guess really all of them. I bet there's some.
No, that's right.
It was created after he left.
I know. That's right. So many have been added since that. Yeah. That I don't think Bud was happy about the way it turned out. But I'm trying to think of other things that I've sort of exhausted my list here.
You mentioned last time as you looked at the years, well, I guess from the time of your directorship up to the current time, that there were some rather disturbing things or things that you thought that we should try to get back to in a sense strengthen our national standing. Mm-hmm. One of them was the greater participation in national organizations. Another one I think you pointed out was this connection with the local state media.
Yeah, right.
And then accreditation, I think, was something else that you mm-hmm. talked about. Are there other things that you could see as directions that we could go in that would be helpful?
All of those are kind of related in a sense that I think that probably can do more with relations with alumni. That some schools have done that much better than we have, I think.
How would we do that? I mean, what would that involve?
It involves one thing, putting out a better alumni newsletter, I guess.
And bring in more of what alumni are doing.
And I don't see many of those, but I just know that I went to Minnesota, so I see that all the time. They've got a lot of problems of their own, which we don't have, but their newsletters have always been very good. Mm-hmm. And the newsletters also reflect the things that they're doing. Another area where I think that we could do a lot more, and it really wouldn't be that hard for. We ought to be bringing people on campus and in our classes and participating. One thing that Minnesota did a lot of, and is still doing a lot of, that they bring well-known journalists and people in the media and the campus, and where they really are involved in things. They used to have in Minnesota, for instance, they had this Gill lecture that was sponsored by the American Newspaper Guild, but. So they provided the money for an annual lecture, and I was there as a graduate student, and they brought in Walter Lippmann and Herb Block, the cartoonist, and a lot of really top-notch national figures, and they would be there for several days, and that's the sort of thing we don't do much of, You don't see many prominent, really prominent. Of course, part of it is it becomes finances, with the lecture fees that. Big names get and so forth nowadays. You can't.
Well, that's true, but there is probably more we could do in that direction. One of the things I suggested was trying to put up a display case out in our lobby where we just would display what people do, their work, their research.
Mm-hmm.
Newspaper articles that they do, magazine pieces or books or whatever. To give a little better sense of what it is we do, so it doesn't look quite so. I don't know, the trophy case we've got.
Well, I think the lobby is a disgrace myself. The only thing that's good about the lobby is the award winners over the years. I consider those PR rewards as awards.
It's like a bowling alley or something.
Yeah, right.
Bowling trophies.
Yeah. Well, when I was director, one thing we did do, we got money from the Edu Foundation, which sort of got to Maury Rubin that time. Did you ever know him? Maury Rubin.
No, I didn't.
He was the editor of the Progressive. Mm-hmm. He was a good newspaper man, but a good journalist. But they had money from Edu Foundation, and he came in one time, when Bud was still director, and said that I wanted to give you $3,000 for an annual lecture. And we said, well, $3,000 won't go very far. But he said, well, that's for each lecture.
Oh.
Of course, that was a lot of money in those days.
Yeah.
This would have been about in the
1970s car election.
Yeah, right. And so that sort of thing we did, and I had, well, I was was director, we had our Buffalo came, and it was a hell of a lot. It was a lot of fun. You know, we went to dinner with them ahead of time, and of course, since it was every lecture, they had people from the Cap Times were involved too. But I forget the other people. But you know, this was a big pre-lecture put on and once a year, and it was put on in the Union Theater.
Yeah.
And I guess the money ran out fairly quickly, but we did it for 5 or 6 times. And you know, that's the kind of thing that that also helped our visibility around the campus too, and which we have not done enough of. And I think that there's kind of a lack of activity around that that sort of thing. Also, that while I'm getting things off my chest, like the awards service thing. Well, that used to be one aspect of what we used to call the Journalism Institutes, where we would have, it would be a 2 or 3 day event, where we would have, like one year we had something on the presidential election, and then we had people from political science and various others who would participate in programs for. And sort of give these guys give the editors some background of what's happening in the coming election, and then there'd be the banquet, and often a well-known person as a speaker. But then we'd give the awards as sort of a side thing. But as we went along more and more, we tended to cut away everything and just make it the awards.
I see. Well, we could come back if you have other final thoughts you want to bring in. I'm not sure that we have talked about your books and your research. I can't remember, but. Just for the record, maybe you could tell us what you consider to be your most important works and a little bit about how they came about.
Okay,
I'm out of order chronologically.
Yeah, that's okay, sure. Well, the first book I did when I first came here, my interest was very much in law of mass communication, and I was... it continued to be an interest, along with my international stuff, and I taught law of the press for a number of years. But I got some research. I had a research assistantship. You know Don Shaw?
Yeah.
He came here as a graduate student, beginning graduate student,
I just saw him at the AEJ.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. The session that I had.
Yeah. Well, Don was just a brand new law graduate student, but very eager and hardworking guy, So I got him. It supported him. It was a research assistantship I had here to support him. What I did was excerpt a lot of decisions of the Supreme Court on what they specifically said about freedom of the press, the various aspects of it. And Don was a big help on this because he really did a lot of the work, or at least digging this stuff up, and that was kind of routine work that he had to do. But anyway, I wrote, that was my first book,
The title of it was?
It was The Supreme Court on Freedom of the Press, uh-huh. Decisions and Dissents. And it was published in 1968 by Iowa State. And I got the Sigma Delta Chi Research Award for it, which surprised me and surprised a lot of other people.
Well, that's very good.
But then I got interested in Africa, and I got involved in the African Studies program. Have I talked about this much at all?
Well, you talked a little bit about being in the African Studies program, but I don't think you really talked much about your
research
and what you wrote. That would be very interesting to...
Yeah, okay, because I had this first trip to Africa in 65, but then I went again in 68, and at that time, in 68, I had a research grant that was sort of a Fulbright research grant. They had some that were not tied to teaching, but they were just for research. And I think they made some available to the universities. Like there was one available to the African Studies program here, and I was the second choice, but the guy who was the first choice didn't want to go, so I got to go and use it. So I visited about 6 or 8 countries, and I was at that time was pretty well had a book idea in mind that I was working on, and so I visited about 6 or 8 countries, and I had been in 4 or 5 before, and so out of that I wrote a book that. Called Muffled Drums, the News Media in Africa, which was published in 71, I guess. And that was very well received, in part because there really hadn't been anything like that for the time when Africa was really kind of coming into attention. And that, and then another one I did was with was the first edition of World News Prism, which was an international, which was a, designed as an introductory textbook in international communications, a supplementary textbook. And in fact, I was kind of started on that when I was at Fulbright, and was a Fulbrighter in Ghana. But it didn't come out until 1981, I think. It was the first edition of 81. And it's in the fourth edition. The fourth edition has just come out this year. I've been updating, and it's done pretty well. It's been, at least, you know, there isn't not that many textbooks to get sold in the international area. But another book that I was enjoyed doing very much was a book on the press in South Africa. That because in the course of my research and writing these other books, I had two or three visits to South Africa, so I really kind of was very much keyed in with the people of South Africa. I had a lot of friends there, and while I was there, I met Tony Giffard. My second trip. I met Tony Giffard, who was teaching at Rhodes University in Grahamstown, English language, the only English language university in South Africa that had a journalism program. And Tony was very interested in what I was doing, and so we became good friends. And he had gotten a PhD at Washington, and he was trying to get back to Washington, and he went back to Washington. And so that by 1981, about the time I stepped down as director, he had been in Washington several years, and we decided we'd do a book on press in South Africa, and called The Press and Apartheid.
What were your impressions of South Africa when you were there, your trips?
Oh, I always found it fascinating. You know, it was a fascinating place to, it was fascinating from the point of view of the press, because there were several different kinds of press. The English language press, which was very much in opposition to the Afrikaner government that had been in control since 1948. And when the Afrikaans press, Afrikaans is a language, the Afrikaans press was very, very much supportive of the National Party, which was the apartheid party. But the English press was very much in opposition to it, and then there was a kind of a small African press that was that didn't have much power, but it was very much in opposition. Of course, the government just treated these black journalists terribly. But I got, we got very closely associated with people at the Rand Daily Mail. The Rand Daily Mail was a paper that was really a very courageous paper that really opposed that, apartheid and tried to be a multiracial paper. I mean, it was edited for the blacks as well as whites. And so there was a lot. It was a very tense, acrimonious situation, but it was fun to be there.
What years were you there?
Well, my first trip there was, I had about five trips there, I guess. First trip was in 65. We were there for several months. And then in 74, when I went, it was only a fairly short trip. This is when Tony invited me to a conference in Grahamstown, I participated there. But then also, 78, I went, and Harva, my wife, and I ran a short course sponsored by the USIA and also the Catholic Bishops Conference in South Africa for black journalists. And this was in 78, and things were very tense in those days. It was kind of fun to do this, because we had about 25 journalists who were all working on black papers, and the poor guys hadn't had any education or didn't know how to write news stories or anything, and so they really welcomed it.
You travel a great deal. I wonder, maybe you could talk a little bit about some of the other places you've been that you found particularly interesting over the years.
Well, of course, Africa was number one. You know, Africa was where we had, because we managed to, in the course of various trips there, that Fulbright and others, that we had a lot of interesting adventures in different parts. And spent a month in Khartoum, in Sudan, in 1985, which was really a great experience. And although it was a very tense kind of a thing, because they killed the U.S. ambassador there about 5 months before, it was in sort of a kind of a quiet period, and they were hoping to have elections, and they were hoping to have a free press. So I was brought in to try to give them some advice on how they could, what they need for a free press. And but that was a real adventure. And while we were there, there were a lot of terrorists around, you know. And Americans were being told not to go to Sudan, and so we had to. The USIA people gave us the option of leaving the country if we wanted to, but we decided to stay. And it was kind of hairy, you know. But we have also I had a trip to about 78. It was 87. I had a research grant that took me to Asia, and where I'd become interested in looking at to compare some other countries, some other areas with the press in South Africa, with the press in Africa. So I visited India, Hong Kong, and Singapore, all of which had been under British colonial rule, and compared the press situations in those countries with what I had seen in Africa. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a little book on that called The Growth of Media in the Third World, in which I did a kind of comparison between those areas. So that was a chance for us to get to Asia.
Is that your only visit to Asia?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Only visit to Asia was in that. I haven't done anything professional. We've traveled just on our own as a tourist to several places in South America, but I haven't done anything professional there. But one thing about being in international communication, that it was a good opportunity for travel.
You know? Oh, yes, I remember. So.
Because you had a Fulbright to Russia.
Soviet Union, yeah.
Central Asia.
It's now the country of Uzbekistan.
Yeah,
it was the Republic of Uzbekistan then.
Yeah, right.
And
so I've often felt that the travel that came with my interest in international, through African studies and related things,
that's just really broadening.
Oh yeah, just added to it.
You see society in a very different way than what you kind of visualize it before you go.
Yeah, that's right. And also, it's like foreign languages. You learn your own society, get to know your own society better, you see it in a comparative sense.
That's right. Are there any other comments or observations you'd like to make on while we have the tape running and run out of tape?
Well, I'd just say that I think that there's a great deal of deja vu about journalism education. A lot of people would say that journalism education is in state of crisis now. Well, it's always been in kind of a state of crisis, and there have always been sort of conflicts between the. In the old days, it was between the so-called chi-squares and the green eye shade. That was sort of the first expression, and that hung on for years. And the green eye shade for the guys that, you know, that worked on the copy desk and the old newspaper men, as against the chi-squares, because that's what these new researchers are all doing. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of conflict, you know, that's... But also, one thing, you know, another thing that, aside from that, there's just been this suspicion between the professional, the working journalists, suspicion of the people who are teaching journalism in a university, and suspicion of their products that they're coming out of. You know. And that lasted a long time, although it's less and less in the sense that more and more of newspapers are made up of people who have some kind of journalism education background. They're certainly college education.
Right.
And that's one of the things, you know, that one of the... there are a great deal of misunderstandings and perceptions between professional media and schools of journalism. And it's also, it's kind of amazing to me that how ill-informed so many people who are top editors and so forth are about journalism education. Because they just never really find out. You know, I was sort of interested to see just recently something by Gene Roberts. Do you know who he is? You know, he's really one of the great editors. It was at the New York Times, and there was a falling out of one way or other. He got passed over, and then he went to the...
He wrote a book recently, didn't he? Or a memoir or something?
Yeah, maybe so. Yeah. But anyway, then he went to the Philadelphia Inquirer, and he did great things at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Now, when Joe Lelefeld became top editor, and he didn't really have a managing editor available. They felt that he would be replaced Lelefeld when he steps down. And so they brought Empire, then was teaching journalism in Maryland, did for 2 or 3 years. Then he was brought back to the New York Times, and he's still back there now, and he's sort of the managing editor, and because they've got a couple of younger guys, I think including a black guy that they want to bring up, but they don't think he's seasoned enough. But anyway, I just saw, all this by way of introduction, that he, I just saw something he said recently. Well, very favorable attitudes toward journalism education, because he was, he's been on the inside, you know, and that's kind of rare. Whereas the New York Times, generally, you know, has always been sort of a hands-off kind of an approach, even though they have hired, you know, the New York Times is full of people that went to Columbia School of Journalism, but, anyway, so what I'm saying is, I guess by winding that up, is that journalism education seems to have these sort of disputes that go on and reappear year later.
Years of,
yeah, that's right. In part because it's not never been able to establish itself as a distinct academic discipline, nor as a really distinct professional school, you know, and so it's always been kind of a limbo.
Limbo in between.
Yeah, it's a field, you know, it's a field of which, as Schramm said, many tarry, but many stop, but few tarry.
I just was reading a piece that Blyer did back in 1930 or 30, early 30s, and he was reacting to a fellow who had written a book on universities, and, you know, they just set up the school here, and this fellow's name was Flexner, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know him?
Yeah, I know the story of what? The guy that did the study of med schools?
Yeah, or universities in general, but he compared journalism to cookery.
Oh, he did? Oh.
Yeah. Well, tell me a little bit, what is your understanding of that?
Of Flexner?
Yeah.
Well, what he did, you know, the way he keeps being called up, you know, he did a survey for somebody, some foundation, mm-hmm. of all the medical schools in the country, and he decided that 3/4 of them ought to be abandoned. And that the few good ones should be encouraged and given financial help and so forth. And so, and that his ideas were followed, and it had a big impact on the reform of medical schools in this country. Mm-hmm. And but somebody said that somebody should do that. You need Flexner to do the same thing with the schools of journalism, to go around and visit all of them and then abandon about 3/4 of them and give resources to them.
This was, I guess, it grew out of a series of lectures he gave in 1928. Mm. But he was very adamantly opposed to setting up school
choice. Oh, was he? Yeah.
And, I just thought that was, it took time away from people who could be studying other more serious things, I guess. But, you know, Blyer always made the comparison that journalism is a profession like law or medicine, because that really was what how people in a democracy got their information.
Yeah.
And if they didn't have a trained corps of journalists,
sure.
Democratic government really didn't have much.
That's right. And it was a public service, you know, it was a public service kind of a thing, and it was a body of knowledge involved. And, you know, I was reading Frank Luther Mott's book on American journalism, which, and he was, you know, really the, I think he still holds up pretty well, he's really one of the great writers, and he knew Blyer and so forth, and in this book he's got a big section on journalism education. He never mentions, not a big section, it's a small section, about the history of journalism education. What's been written around 1940, I would think, but he hardly any mention of Blyer.
Well,
and yet they knew each other, but I think there was a lot of rivalry between Missouri and Wisconsin.
I think Missouri, their school predated Wisconsin's, didn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah,
we got in on the setting up graduate program, I think.
Yeah, and they were right from the beginning. And, you know, Mott was not, well, he was associated with him a long time, but he wasn't really involved in developing the school. But there was another guy whose name escapes me right now, who's sort of the counterpart to Blyer, mm-hmm. and whose approach was very much a professional one.
As opposed to more research-oriented?
Because Blyer was really trying to bring it into the academic.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it shows that the ideas, but I think now it's generally recognized, so that Blyer's role, I think it isn't just a conspiracy of the people of Wisconsin who publicized Blyer, don't you think?
Oh, no, not at all. I think that's quite true. He certainly made a large point of trying to professionalize journalism, you know, setting up professional associations, and that was very important.
Yeah.
So, Well, maybe this is a good place to stop since we're probably close to running out of tape.
and ideas
also, but we can also, if we have other things, come back to this and pick it up later. So
okay.
Thank you very much.